ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci alongside Connor Kelly. As always, thank you so much for joining us. And I also want to thank our brand new sponsor, Legg Mason. Really excited to have their exclusive sponsorship of our podcast. We have a great show lined up today. In just a moment, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger. We're going to pick up on a conversation Laura and I had really throughout last year, which has to do with ESG ETFs, socially responsible ETFs. So I think this continues to be one of the more fascinating segments of the ETF market because there's a ton of buzz, a lot of attention around this space, but investor interest still continues to be lukewarm at best. So Laura and I are going to look back at ESG ETF flows in 2018. We'll discuss some of the opportunities and challenges moving forward, and then also touch on the world's cheapest ESG ETF portfolio that Laura put together last week, and whether falling fees might ultimately be enough to help ESG ETFs take off. We'll then be joined by Bob Smith, President and Chief Investment Officer at Sage Advisory. Sage manages over $13 billion. They're one of the largest tactical ETF managers in the country. And one of the areas they focus on is ESG. They incorporate ESG factors into a number of their investment strategies. They also offer an ESG-focused bond ETF. So we're going to cover this ESG topic with Bob as well, why he thinks it's important. We'll spotlight that ETF and also hear why he thinks ESG ETFs have been a bit slow to gain traction. You know, Connor, I know we've discussed this topic of ESG quite a bit. I just think it's really interesting because there seems to be a disconnect between fund companies offering these ETFs and whether investors actually want them. And I guess I just continue to be fascinated to see how this ultimately ends up playing out.
Well, you look at some of the companies backing these ESG products, and these aren't fringe players. I mean, iShares, Vanguard, and Goldman Sachs have actually all launched ESG-focused ETFs somewhat recently. But if I had to sum up the overall view of investors towards these products, with one word, it would probably be indifferent. I mean, the fund flows simply aren't there in a meaningful way for these ESG funds yet. And the question is, why not? I think the main reason is that most investors are taking a wait-and-see approach. Look, most people would like to invest in companies that aren't bad actors, right? That aren't polluters, that hire diverse employees, et cetera. I believe most people would like to invest like that. But investing is about making money. And so many of these funds that are ESG focused are new and they don't have a meaningful track record yet. And I think if some of these ESG funds do end up in the next couple of years, let's say, matching their index or even showing a little bit of outperformance over meaningful period, 3 to 5 years, let's say, I think the story of ESG investing totally changes because real money could start being invested. But until then, I just think most investors are waiting to see how things play out from a performance standpoint.
Well, and again, I know we've covered this topic quite a bit. I just think it's important to continue talking about this because, to your point, fund companies are putting a lot of effort into this space. And somebody like Vanguard, they don't typically just throw ETF ideas out there, right?
No,
they're very meticulous with their launches. So something has to give here. And, you know, like you said, I think we would all agree we want companies to be better actors, environmentally, socially, whatever. But is an investment portfolio the best place to push for that? I think that's clearly still up for debate. All right, so ESG is the topic in the first part of the show. And then in the back half, we're going to be joined by Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. So they have a lineup of what are called defined outcome ETFs. These offer exposure to the S&P 500, where you have a cap to the upside, but also downside protection. In other words, you can buy an ETF where, let's say, you get all of the returns up to about 10% on the upside, but then you have a buffer where you don't participate in the first 15% of losses to the downside. These are generating quite a bit of buzz right now. I was looking over the weekend. Believe it or not, these already have nearly $300 million invested in them. The first series just launched last August. So these certainly seem to be resonating with investors, and we'll dig into all the details with Bruce later in the show. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Let's start today with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Laura, it's funny. I think this topic of ESG is just going to be our little thing, probably along with Bitcoin ETFs. But, you know, look, in all seriousness, this is an important topic. As I mentioned at the top, I think we would all agree we want companies to do better, right? We want them doing the right things as it relates to the environment, social issues, corporate governance. But it has been well documented ESG ETF flows haven't really been there yet. Investor interest has been lukewarm in this space, I would say, at best. So I guess before we talk about the reasons why, first, maybe just set the table for us. What did ESG ETF flows look like in 2018, and where do we stand right now?
Sure. I knew you were going to drag me on. You were going to drag me today. So in 2018, we had about $2.6 billion of new investment money coming into the ESG ETF space, and that's good. Comparatively, I mean, that's a 62% gain year over year. And yet, $2.6 billion isn't really that much, considering we saw $316 billion go into all ETFs as a whole in 2018. I mean, in terms of flows, we're still in the trickle territory when it comes to ESG ETFs. We're not seeing a deluge of money coming into these funds. So I think as of the end of 2018, we had assets under management in all ESG ETFs at about $7.5 billion. And that is 31% growth year over year. Again, totally respectable, except it's just not very much in the grand scheme of things. It's just a drop in the bucket, really. So to the point that you made earlier about when are we going to see ESG ETFs take off, why aren't they taking off? I wanted to make the point that I feel like there's a lot of expectation for ESG ETFs to become overnight barn burners. Like, we're always waiting for this to, you know, quote unquote, be the year that ESG takes off, right? And I'm starting to think that maybe it's just not going to happen that way. Maybe it's going to be, if and when ESG finds success in ETF form, maybe it's not going to be a stampede towards these funds. Maybe it'll be because you have years like last year with respectable, comparatively large gains in flows and assets, And those years will happen 20 years in a row, right? So it'll be a snowball that builds into an avalanche.
Well, you know, at the end of last year, you joined us on the program and you gave us your 2019 ETF predictions. And one of them, which I know pained you, was that ESG ETFs will continue to underwhelm. And you pinpointed three reasons why. You said, number one, you have to explain what ESG means, right? The acronym is confusing. Number two, you said performance has been middling. And then three, there's still not enough price competition, that maybe fees still need to come down further. And we'll get to the third reason in just a moment. But on the first two, any proposed solutions here? Obviously, you know, performance is what it is. What about on the acronym? And I guess as it relates to performance, do providers need to maybe target higher tracking error, right? And not just try to match non-ESG benchmarks?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So as far as the acronym goes, oh my Lord, the ESG acronym is something we in the writer's room are litigating all the time. Nobody likes it. It's the dentist's waiting room of acronyms. It's just awful. Personally, I like impact investing because it kind of captures the sense that people who are investing in these products are trying to make an impact with their capital besides just making money. But even that is really not perfect. And I don't have an answer. I wish I did. I'd be a gajillionaire if I did. So as far as performance goes, it is a persistent misconception that ESG underperforms vanilla funds. These actually ESG ETFs, on the majority of them, tend to outperform their vanilla counterparts of 17 of the 26 U.S. stock ESG ETFs are outperforming SPY, for example, or they did last year. But the thing is, the margins by which they're outperforming aren't really fantastic. They, you know, it's on the order of a percent or two. So is that really enough to offset what's usually, you know, higher price tag, higher spreads? I don't know. That's not a judgment call I can make, but it seems like investors are saying, no, it's not enough. And then, as Connor said earlier, there's no track record for many of these funds. There's just, it's maybe a year or two because this is still such a new space. So maybe there really is that wait and see approach happening as well. So I think you're going to need to see performance really outdo the broader market to bring all, you know, I was about to say, bring all the boys to the yard. But, you know, to just bring in those assets. So.
Well, yeah, and you know, the term that gets floated out there, maybe a bit derogatory, is greenwashing, right? Where these funds, again, are effectively just trying to track a non-ESG benchmark. So, you know, again, do you think the answer there might be greater tracking error, maybe trying for higher active share to try to move the needle on performance?
Sure. It's not a bad strategy. Many of the outperforming ETFs in the ESG space are ones that step away from these broad-based benchmarks that you know, have been green screened for ESG principles. They take a stance. They're thematic. They might be you know, very, very narrow niche funds. So, I mean, there's certainly room for that as well. I don't know that greenwashing has become a hurdle for mom-and-pop investors. You know, I don't think that's necessarily what's holding them back from investing in these funds, because there's so little understanding, general understanding about what ESG ETFs are. But I do think it's going to become a more visible issue moving forward as people learn more about these funds and try to make the decisions whether or not to hold them. You know, if you're investing your money to make a difference, you're going to be kind of peeved if you find out that your money is in an Exxon or a Facebook or, you know, these companies that have these egregious abuses or controversies happening.
We were talking earlier about how assets in ESG ETFs overall are obviously on the light side, given there's three what, $0.4 trillion in ETFs overall. But something interesting you wrote a few weeks ago was that a quarter of all assets managed in the U.S. were invested according to ESG principles, with a big chunk of that in actively managed mutual funds. And you talked about how that actually might be one of the reasons ESG ETFs have been slow to take off. I'm curious, why is that? Because actively managed mutual funds seem to be hemorrhaging money everywhere else. So why not in ESG?
I'm so glad you brought it up, because I really do think this is one of the significant reasons why we haven't seen a lot of money go into ESG ETFs. And it's because mutual funds, the people who are investing in ESG instruments in general tend to be true believers, right? They want to make a difference. So they're willing to stick out periods of bad performance because they believe so much in what they're trying to do. Like, if you believe that renewable energy is going to save our planet, you're not going to pull your money from a renewable energy fund and plunk it into a crude oil fund just because, you know, that clean energy fund might be down half a percentage point in comparison, right? Like, that's not going to happen. So given how widespread ESG principles are in the mutual fund space, I think you have a lot of investors, mutual fund investors, who are willing to stand by these less than ideal instruments. They're willing to pay the higher fees. They're willing to suck up the lower performance of active mutual funds. And they're not shifting to these cheaper, more effective, better performing ETFs simply because they believe so strongly in what they put their money into that they're not going to entertain the possibility of change. I also think, too, that there's an element of, you know, true believers get in early, right? So there's probably people who got in early and they don't want to realize the capital gains on their investments that they got into years and years ago. And then you incur the tax hit that comes with that. So.
Laura, we have just a couple minutes left. I do want to make sure we touch on fees. And last week, you also wrote a great piece where you put together the world's cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. And you highlighted the fact that ESG ETF fees have continued to come down. Can you just briefly walk us through that portfolio? And overall, do you think fees have fallen enough, or is there still work to do here?
So, yeah, the world's cheapest ESG ETF portfolio is a play off of something that our old CEO, Matt Hogan, used to put together, where he'd pick the cheapest ETFs in six asset classes just to see how low he could get the total overall fee of the portfolio. And so I did the same thing just with ESG ETFs. And in that fund, or excuse me, in that portfolio, you've got kind of a diversity of funds from several issuers. You've got funds like the Vanguard U.S. ESG U.S. Stock ETF, that's ESGZ. You've got the iShares ESG U.S. Aggregate Bond ETF, that's EAGG. And basically, with one or two exceptions, you've got what I call green-screened versions of a standard index ETF, so like an EAM or an EFA, just with ESG principles and screens laid on top of it. I had to fudge a little bit for real estate and commodities because there aren't really any ESG funds in those spaces yet, and I'm not really sure there will be for a while. But overall, I think it was kind of a fair representation of what the space had to offer. And this portfolio carries a 17 basis point blended expense ratio. That's pretty darn good, I think. And depending on what asset allocation you go with, you can even get the expense ratio lower. A 60-40 ESG ETF portfolio, for example, that's just 13 basis points. So as to your question about whether fees have come down enough, my answer, whether it's ESG or not, it's always going to be no. You know, there's always going to be room to fall for almost every space in the ETF industry. There's certainly more room for ESG ETFs to come down in price. But at the same time, there are cheap options out there if people want to find them. And I don't think anybody would be complaining with a portfolio that costs just 17 basis points.
Well, Laura, with that, we're going to have to leave it there. Always fun chatting. I suspect this is not going to be the last time you and I discuss ESG. So I look forward to our future conversations, but I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our focus on ESG investing. We'll be joined by Bob Smith, president of Sage Advisory. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime, Nate and Connor in studio. Our next guest today is Bob Smith, President and Chief Investment Officer at Sage Advisory. Sage manages over $13 billion. They're one of the largest tactical ETF managers in the country. And one of the areas they focus on is ESG strategies, where they incorporate environmental, social, and governance factors into their investment approach. That includes an ETF they offer, the Sage ESG Intermediate Credit ETF, ticker symbol GUDB. And ESG will be the focus of our conversation with Bob today, who is now joining us via phone from Austin, Texas. Bob, a pleasure having you on the program.
Good morning, Nate. How are you today?
I'm doing well. You know, there's a lot I want to cover today on ESG investing. But first, can you just give us some background on Sage Advisory, perhaps how you became involved in ETFs and where this focus on ESG came from?
Sure. Well, Sage Advisory is a registered investment advisory firm. We're largely institutionally oriented, started back in 1996, and we were primarily a fixed income manager, but we started investing in ETFs in about 1998 selectively for some of our clients, and into the early 2000s started to build out our tactical ETF strategies, both in terms of equity markets as well as fixed income. At around 2005, we had clients that had increasingly asked us to become more aware of responsible forms of investment, some of that socially screened, some of that more ESG-oriented. And I would say that in about the mid-2000s, we became much more aggressively involved with the notion of responsible investing. And today, within our assets, we're somewhere in and around $800 million out of the $13 billion that are very much directed towards responsible and ESG investing.
All right. So anytime we visit with someone on ESG investing, I always like to ask for their definition of ESG, because it does seem like there are a lot of different interpretations out there. So how do you define ESG, and how should investors think about this space?
Sure. Well, ESG investing is best defined as an investment approach and a method of analysis that incorporates environmental, social, and governance factors into the evaluation, the selection, and the management of investments. And it's through this kind of an application that we seek to mitigate risk and then enhance long-term investment performance. And we believe that responsible investing requires consideration of not only future market trends, but also societal expectations of corporate responsibility that can affect growth and risk factors within an industry or a company's business model. That may make them increasingly unsustainable. And so we think this is kind of consistent with our fiduciary responsibilities. We also think that ESG integration and the assessment of all of those factors will result in better investment outcomes for our clients and a much closer alignment between their objectives and those of society at large. So we're value-driven, but we're pragmatic in the way we apply our ESG analysis.
Well, and the nice thing is we can talk about a real-world example, because your firm offers the Sage ESG Intermediate Credit ETF, ticker symbol GUDB. Interestingly, there haven't been near as many ESG bond ETF launches as there have been on the equity side. But what was the decision-making behind launching this ETF? And then tell us about the investment process here.
Sure. Well, being primarily a fixed income manager, we felt that this was a natural, logical extension of what we do in our conventional fixed income products. The space is absolutely a void. As we sit today, there's probably 8 ETFs that are in the ESG fixed income space. roughly totaling maybe $311 million in size, so not a great amount. And indeed, the whole responsible investing area is still growing, but if you were to take all of the funds and the ETFs that are in the Morningstar universe that would be categorized as socially responsible, in today's world, we're talking about $222 billion, which quite frankly is less than 4.8% of all funds in the Morningstar universe and less than 2% of the assets. Now, that's up you know, over the last 5 years, but it's still growing. The area of fixed income, as far as we're concerned, you know, as I said, there were only 8 ETFs. iShares or BlackRock dominates. They have half of the offerings that are out there. And we wanted to kind of stick to our competency. Our core competency is intermediate fixed income, but we wanted to do this with an ESG extension. So what are we doing? We're looking at and focusing on those companies that are intentionally and consciously building and promoting sustainable business practices and product development. So what do we do? Our key features in terms of the GUDB ESG ETF is that we want to look at a variety of different factors. First off, we do comparative analysis and a lot of data analysis, looking for those companies that score extremely well in the ESG space. So out of a score of 0 to 100, we want companies that have at least 50% or higher in their overall scores of how good they are from an ESG perspective. The second thing that we want to look at in selecting companies is we want to make sure that they're in the top one-third of their peer group, their industry. So no matter how well you score individually, you better do well as being a leader within your community from an ESG perspective. And then from there, what we want to make sure is that we don't have any controversies of any significance. So we generally look for those who have very low controversy scores, you know, level one, level two, you know, five being the worst. But that's how we pick our particular bonds. And then lastly, we want to make sure we have a liquid tradable portfolio, because in ETFs, that's always the rub. How marketable is it that these particular securities held within the ETF? So for us, different from many of the other competitors that we see in that group of eight, is that we want a minimum of $500 million of outstanding paper for an issue before we will use it in GUDB. That says a lot about liquidity and marketability and availability. And then the last thing is we want to make sure that we only own bonds that were issued within the last 3 years. We don't want bonds that were issued 20 years ago, 5 years ago. We want current coupon, fresh crop bonds. So when you add that all together, what does GUDB do? First of all, we our key feature of liquidity screening to minimize trading costs and of the underlying assets is paramount, because that's a killer, particularly in fixed income, in terms of ETF efficiency and really reflecting the market. The next thing is that we have a comprehensive ESG kind of factor optimization. We want the best actors, and so we don't want companies that are incidentally sustainable. You don't buy companies that are accidentally sustainable for GUDB. We want intentionally sustainable companies. And the duration and the risk characteristics of GUDB have to match up with the broader credit index. And so the index that we compare ourselves to is the Barclays Bloomberg Credit Index, Intermediate Credit Index. And over since its inception in 2017, the index that we built in order to generate this ETF has tracked extremely well to the broader market, with only about 125 holdings versus the broad index of over 5,000 holdings. The tracking error of this ETF is roughly 19 basis points, but it's got the same credit quality, same duration, slightly better yield, and incrementally since inception, you know, based on the index, it's outperformed the broader market index by roughly 25 to 30 basis points. So all in all, the ESG score is for the average holding is about an 81 out of 100, whereas the broad market sits somewhere down at around 63%. So what are we doing? We're giving you good market returns. We're giving you a very liquid, tradable, marketable ETF. And we are also giving you demonstrably higher ESG values contained within our portfolio. So we believe that this is a portfolio of really fine companies that really are intended and do execute sustainable business practices.
Bob, you mentioned this ETF. Its underlying benchmark is the Barclays Credit Intermediate Index. And I was visiting earlier with ETF.com's Laura Krieger on this, but one of the criticisms I've heard of ETFs that effectively seek to offer similar characteristics to an underlying benchmark like that, but with an ESG overlay, is that it's quote-unquote greenwashing, that these products really aren't much different from non-ESG indexes, right? They're just marketing under the ESG umbrella. I'm curious, any thoughts or response to that?
Well, yeah, greenwashing can be a big problem within the industry by and large, and we do see a fair amount of it. I would say, you know, green labeling happens a lot in the green bond market in terms of issuance and so forth. But what do we do? What makes us different is that we have Sustainalytics every 6 months, and Sustainalytics is a well-known independent research shop that has specialized in ESG metrics and analysis for decades. They review our framework, our ESG framework for picking bonds and identifying securities that are optimal from an ESG perspective. And we use that framework, and then what they will do is every 6 months they will sit down and review our framework and the compliance of each and every one of our securities to that ESG framework to make sure that we are bringing our investors what we say we're bringing them. So we believe in second-party verification by an independent firm that can audit the compliance of our ESG principles and framework so that we are actually bringing the most optimal combination of securities based on what we feel is important from an ESG factor perspective. You don't find that a lot within the bond market by and large. I wouldn't say it's similar to a GIPS compliance, but very close. And so we publish those results every 6 months. They're available on our website. And I think those are some of the ways in which you can avert or you can respond to the greenwashing issue that is out in the marketplace today. That's not something that Sage, you know, is worried about. And in order to prove that, we do publish those audit results.
Our guest is Bob Smith, President and Chief Investment Officer at Sage Advisory. Bob, we have a few minutes left here. You know, overall, the adoption of ESG ETFs has been a bit slow to materialize, at least compared to the amount of attention ESG seems to generate. I'm curious, why do you think that is? I mean, right now, ESG assets are less than like $10 billion of the $3.4 trillion in total ETF assets. Why aren't there more assets here?
Well, you know, look, whether ESG investing adds alpha or is a source of endless debate and countless academic studies, but regardless, the importance of ESG factors within investing has increased exponentially over the last few years, largely on the institutional side as opposed to what I would say the mutual fund and the ETF side, but it's coming. According to the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investing, their 2018 report, we know that assets in the United States now are up to roughly $12 trillion in size that have a sustainable or an impact-oriented form of investing. That's 38% higher than where we were 2 years ago. And according to XTF Research, ESG-oriented ETFs now hold roughly about $7.3 billion in assets. And over the year through November, we know that they had something in the order of $1.7 billion of new flows. Now, I will tell you that this is something that over the course of time, as investment results prove that ESG investing is beneficial, that more and more investors will come this way. I think it's a problem of education and understanding. Let's also understand that in 2018, of the top 10 equity funds in terms of performance in a very rough year, four of the top 10 funds in America were those that had sustainable investing mandates. And so when you look at how well, you know, sustainable investing is done, in those very rough periods of time as we've just come through, you can clearly see on the equity side that the vast majority, a much larger percentage of responsible investing mutual funds outperform the S&P 500, something like 40% of the universe, compared to just 36% of the broad market, you know, normal mutual fund or regular mandated funds. So I think it's a period, it's a issue of time, issue of understanding and education. But we're finding that more and more advisors are seeing more and more demand coming from the average retail investor, as well as what we see in the institutional space.
Well, Bob, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there. Really appreciate your perspective today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Nate, and enjoyed speaking with you.
That was Bob Smith, President and Chief Investment Officer at Sage Advisory. And you can learn more about their ESG ETF by visiting sageadvisory.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to spotlight a unique lineup of ETFs. They're called defined outcome ETFs. These allow you to participate in stock market growth up to a certain cap, and then they also provide a defined level of downside protection. We'll be joined by Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. Let's go right to our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
We're actually spotlighting a suite of ETFs this week, the Innovator Defined Outcome ETFs. These provide upside exposure to the S&P 500 up to a certain cap, and then they have a defined downside buffer to help mitigate losses. They're the first ETFs of their kind, and joining us via phone from Chicago to discuss these ETFs is Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. Bruce, great having you on the program today.
Thank you, Nate, for having me.
Bruce, first, where did you come up with the idea for these ETFs, and why did you think there was a need in the marketplace?
Well, you know, we have a lot of history in the market and looking at ETFs and kind of understanding what investors are interested in. And I think one of my partners here had invested in a annuity that gave him certain protections and kind of guaranteed outcomes. And we got together and talked and said, you know, I mean, why couldn't we provide something like this in an ETF where investors would be more comfortable investing in the equity markets knowing that they had a built-in buffer, but that they would have participation on the upside. And so the more we looked into it, we realized that no one had done it, and there were some particulars that we had to figure out, but we were able to, you know, engineer something that really is very elegant, I think, and serves investors well.
All right, so let's maybe have you walk through how these ETFs are constructed, and then we can get into all the details on how investors can best use them. So explain the construction here. What do these hold, and how exactly do they work?
Well, I mean, the one way to think about them is they're very simple. It's like buying the S&P 500 ETF, any S&P 500 ETF. And what they do, though, is that they have a built-in buffer. And there's three different levels of buffers that are provided. One is a 9% buffer. Now, with that 9% buffer, you have a 22%, when they were originally launched here, a 22% cap. And then there's a second fund that has a 15% buffer. It has a 13.9% cap. And then there's a third one that has a 30% buffer. Now, it buffers you between -5 and -35%, and it has a 12% cap. And so that's the way to think about them real simply is, you know, it's buying an S&P 500 ETF with certain built-in buffers, and the greater the buffer, the lower your cap, the less upside you get. And that's really what the cost is, you know, and how they're financed. Now, what they're built out of, each of the ETFs are built using what are called flex options. Flex options are really a very simple way to say a custom option. And there's six or seven options in each of the portfolios. And the reason we use these flex options that are called custom is because we can say, okay, they start on exactly this day, and they end all together at the same time on this day. And by doing that, we're able to give you this particular defined outcome very precisely on a particular day in the future and allows investors to know even before they buy, okay, this is my outcome and what the outcome will be.
And Bruce, to be clear, that outcome, that is point to point. In other words, that defined outcome you will receive if you purchase the ETF on day one.
Exactly. If you purchase it on day one, when the fund resets, and you hold it till the end of the year, and it's really easy to see. If you look at the website, you can see, okay, I'm buying today, and this is the end, you know, like when the options expire. So this is when they would reset, and that would be the period. And I mentioned earlier, you know, these caps are all set on the day that the funds actually came to market. This is a new series of funds, and but that will reset each year. And so you can look at that each day, though, because they move around a little bit, you know, as a basket of options will do in the market. They track closely the S&P 500, but they won't be exactly on top of the S&P 500. You need to hold it over the year, what we call the outcome period. You have to hold it for that entire period, and at the end of that period, you will get the result of what it says. Now, there's some tools that are on the website that you can look on any particular day, and you can say, okay, if I bought today and purchased at this price, this would be my outcome at the end of this outcome period.
What happens at the end of each outcome period? So if I'm an investor holding these for, you know, let's say a few years, at the end of each outcome period, what will the experience be?
What the experience will be at the end of the outcome period is that the portfolio of options, the basket of options, will reset into a new outcome. Now, what changes on the particular outcome is the cap. So, for example, if you bought the 9% buffer, it's approximately 1 year, 365 days.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bought that, it will go out 365 days, would be the end of your new outcome period. You would get a new 9% buffer, depending on what happened in the market. You get a 9% buffer. And then the cap will adjust. Now, the caps move based on the amount of volatility in the market and the dividend. There are several factors that go into determining the cap. But the cap will move around based on the amount of volatility in the market. And typically, the greater the volatility, the greater the cap, which is a good thing. You don't see that with a lot of other risk-type products. I mean, inherently, you would think, well, the more risk, the lower the cap, you know, but actually with these products, it's the opposite of that. That's why when we saw this volatility recently in December, that the cap on the 9%er shot up to 22%, the 20 range, because the greater amount of volatility, the greater cap. It's good for investors as you go into the future, because if you think about it, if you reset, if it's a really volatile market, you'll capture the upside of that market or more of the upside of that market in the following year. So, you know, you're not stuck at 22% every year or 13% or 12% every year. You know, those caps will adjust a little bit depending on the volatility of the market at that given point when the portfolio resets.
If there's effectively zero volatility in the markets, you know, maybe something like we saw in 2017, is it possible that upside cap comes down, you know, so significantly that it becomes a problem?
I don't think it would ever become a problem. There's, I think really we saw over this last bull market that we've had, we saw some of the least amount of volatility and just an upward trending market. And originally when these products came to market, the caps were, you know, for the 30% were around, you know, like 8%, and for the 15% buffer, they were more like around, you know, about the same 8 or 9%. And then for the 9% buffer, they were more in like the 10 to 12% range. And so we've actually seen them move up substantially over the period. And but I think those rates that we saw initially when we introduced the initial suite of funds was about as low as we would see. And historically, we've been able to look back at the history of the caps and find that that's really pretty low, and that we're actually more in kind of an average period right now where the caps are at this point. So I think we would expect to see them stay in this range going forward.
Our guest is Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. We're spotlighting the Innovator-defined outcome ETFs. Bruce, you began alluding to this a bit earlier, but from an investor education perspective, one of the things I worry about with these products is investors purchasing them somewhere during the outcome period, right? So let's say stocks have declined 10% and an investor purchases the 15% power buffer ETF. I guess the question is, do you worry that someone may think they still have 15% protection to the downside when in fact they only have 5%?
I do worry about that, to be honest with you, Nate. And that's the reason we appreciate you having us on the program, an opportunity to talk to people about it, to make sure they're educated, you know, on exactly how the products work. I think the important thing is for anyone who is going to buy after the initial offering day is to go to the website or to secure a rate sheet from us to understand exactly what they're buying at a given price. And so people need to understand that obviously if you buy and the market's down, you know, 15%, you know, you're not going to have the amount of protection in the 15% buffer as you did at the very beginning. Now the you probably would likely have some buffer left, but not nearly 15%. But if you go to the website and look at it, it will tell you, well, you've got 8% left or 9% left or something in this range. I think the great thing, though, is if you do buy it and you understand up front exactly when you're getting in and what your opportunity is, on a go-forward basis, if you let that asset stay within the funds, they will reset on the exact date that you want them to, and the options will expire and continue to roll over and deliver the outcome that you're hoping for. And so you will be provided a 9% buffer on an ongoing basis with whatever cap the market will deliver to you, or a 15% or a 30% buffer with the caps provided by the market at that given time.
Bruce, assuming investors fully understand their upside cap and downside buffer, which again, you have on the website, look, these products sound great, right? They're pretty straightforward if you look under the hood. Are there any hidden risks or other surprises here, things that may happen that could cause some sort of an issue for these ETFs?
No, I really don't think so. You know, I think the one... did 3.5 million shares on the first day that the January funds were listed. And so, you know, it's a normal, you know, it's a good amount of volume for initial listing. And so I think with new products like this, you always want to be careful when you go in and purchase. And what we typically recommend is, you know, right when the market opens and right when the market closes, you want to avoid those two periods if you can, and you want to use a limit order to buy them. Understand what price you're willing to purchase at and put a limit order in. And so that would be the only thing that I would just urge people that are interested in investing, is to understand the product well and what their outcome will be. And then secondly, when they go to purchase, to just to understand how to put in a limit order and what price to put it in at. Other than that, you know, the great thing about these products is that for anyone who's familiar with, like, you know, structured products or annuities, these types of products, these ETFs, because of the structure, remove many of the obstacles in these older structures and actually make them much more efficient to participate in.
Bruce, I don't want to get too far into the weeds. We have about 2 minutes left here. Is there anything unique about the creation redemption process here, or the ability of authorized participants to keep the ETF share prices in line with net asset value, or is that process pretty straightforward?
That process is pretty straightforward too. It's not dissimilar than a bond ETF. These creates are done in cash, so the cash comes in a create. We purchase the options basket, and I think the interesting thing is sometimes there's you know, people think there's a lot of voodoo around options and what's actually happening because they're not so familiar with them. But really, you know, the basket that we set at the beginning of the options that are going to be the options we're going to use going forward are the same ones we purchase all through the period. And it's like a basket of tech stocks. You know, these are the tech stocks we're going to buy for this particular portfolio through the period, and you just keep buying them through the period. So it's actually very straightforward. Because they are in the S&P 500 index options, these are among the most liquid securities in the world, with over, you know, $1 trillion in open interest in these securities each day. So it's tremendously liquid. The spreads on the funds are actually pretty tight. I did mention, you know, be careful when you put a trade in, but, you know, the spreads are tight for what they are. And, you know, there really aren't a lot of risk when it comes to the creation redemption process.
Well, Bruce, we're out of time. Really appreciate you joining us today. Congratulations on the launch of this lineup. I was looking over the weekend and saw that the nine ETFs under this series already have nearly $300 million in assets. So these are clearly resonating with investors. We wish you all the best and hope to chat again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Bruce Bond, CEO of Innovator ETFs. And you can learn more about their defined outcome ETFs by visiting InnovatorETFs.com. I do want to emphasize what Bruce was saying there with the upside cap and the downside buffer. If you're not purchasing these products on day one, as the market moves, that upside cap's going to move and that downside buffer may move in terms of what your experience will be. And if you go to the website, InnovatorETFs.com, for each of the ETFs, you can see the exact remaining cap as well as the downside buffer. So, that should be a no-brainer. If you're going to buy these things outside of the outcome period or during the outcome period, you have to look at that. In any event, I think really interesting ETFs and, again, clearly resonating with investors. That'll do it for ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, iTunes, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Next week, we'll welcome Connor O'Brien, CEO of O'Shares, onto the program. You might be familiar with O'Shares because of Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful from ABC's Shark Tank. He's actually behind the O'Shares lineup of ETFs, and Connor's going to walk us through their factor-based approach to investing, including the O'Shares FTSE U.S. Quality Dividend ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.